Okay. So the first thing I want to point out is, as I mentioned in the mail after the class, we would actually be discussing the Google papers, the two papers that I mentioned last time. Which are the two? So that anatomy of hypertextual search engine, and the other one is challenges in web search engines. We'll discuss those two next class, and I shifted it to next class because I want you to read it before you come to the class. I know that you're supposed to read everything before coming to the class, but you know how that goes. And however, next time you're actually going to discuss this, so you could use next class as a kind of a review of everything that happened until now, okay, except clustering, which would not be discussed by then. So you should read this, and then, you know, I'll try to send a couple of notes on what you should look for. Maybe I'll add a homework problem, homework question to kind of make you do directed reading. But definitely read and, you know, get a perspective of what we have done till now, and also how it compares to what Google was doing some years back at least. And then we'll discuss those. Okay. So today's class, I'll actually be doing clustering. So clustering would now wind up spanning Monday's class. Next Monday, we'll do again, go back and do the search stuff. As long as if you don't actually speak, then I'll go back and do more clustering next class. So we could, you know, do more stuff if you have nothing to discuss. But I would like to give you a chance to actually look at it. Okay. Any questions on that stuff? Okay. I did send you guys this. I don't really know whether there's anything to be discussed here, but let me do it so that you'd say I discussed this. This is essentially the summary of the aggregate feedback that I received from all the people. I think 19 people did it, and the numbers don't add up because some people just skipped some questions, so that's fine. So this is probably the most important thing, and you know, these code words are really somewhat fast means just right, and just right means kind of slow. And so I think actually we're okay as far as speed is concerned. It looks, nobody seems to think that we're going too fast, so that's good. This is sort of neat. Mostly I don't know what I can say about them, but you know, some of the topics that people remember till now, I guess. Homeworks, how homeworks are going, how lectures are going. One thing that somebody pointed out, and you know, I wish I did it earlier, but I did not, so is whether the results would actually be significantly different if I were to separate undergraduate and graduate students. I don't know, because I didn't ask you as one of the questions, and so it's the pattern on the whole class. One particular undergraduate student actually sent me a mail saying undergraduates really think that it's going much faster, but they didn't want to tell you that because they might fail the course. If you are so afraid that you won't even put a circle around too fast, then I can't really help. But I'm assuming that that's probably just somebody's expectation. But I would still be, as I said, I did give a way in which you can send me your other concerns. You know, this is, we are living in the era of internet, okay, so you have lots and lots of ways of telling your concerns to me without giving yourself away to the extent that's an issue. And I gave you a simple way, which is just do internet-based, hyperlink-based mail, but that gives me your IP address away. So if you call your IP address, if your computer is named after you, then that's not a good deal. But there are also anonymous remailers out there. You know, you can actually use those. So if these things, to the extent these things don't reflect the way your individual experience about this class is, then you are in trouble, because this is what I'm believing right now. So you need to tell me now, you know, what else is bothering you. Okay. What else is there? So apparently, I don't know, what else can I say here? Oh, the one thing that I wanted to, where is this? This, the, do people think that, my office hours, I've been in ASU for what, 15 years or something now, and my office hours are the most relaxing time in my life. Nobody shows up. And, you know, it's like, you know, I could be sleeping, nobody ever disturbs me. No, department forces me to put 2 office hours, and I do, but nobody shows up. But assuming that it's just my office that you guys don't like, and you like to go to some other office, you know, maybe if people think that TA should have hours to help with the project, you know, I would be happy to ask him to have one hour every week. Right now, I think we're just doing demand-driven. I mean, if you have questions, then you're sending a mail to the TA, report the project and so on, and then he's getting back to you. I think people have met you one-on-one too, right? Till now, it's not, yeah. So if people want more help, should let me know. So we'll have TA hours. I just don't want him to sleep too, the way I sleep in my 2 hours. That's the only reason. That's something that we can easily do in terms of TA hours. So that you can just send me an email. You know, if you can send me, tell me now, how many people think a TA hour, an actual time for a TA hour would help as against what currently is the situation? Okay, 2 people. Okay, we'll probably add, we'll find out what they're available at, and then we can figure out some hour. Okay, that's overly inflated time, I think. 63% apparently are reading up all the papers before coming to the class. I'm really happy to hear that, but this makes me feel good. These are probably the 2 truthsayers in this class. But anyway, that's pretty much what I had. I always think that I speak. In fact, in any room I am in, if others don't speak, I will. Okay, so it's true, you know, there's this joke about, how many of you read this book by, what's her name now, I forgot, Deborah Tannen, on You Just Don't Understand, about how men and women speak in different ways. And there's a joke that she relates there where this woman is asking for a divorce from the husband on grounds that the husband never spoke to her in like 20 years. And the judge asked the husband, you know, what's your excuse? He said, I was waiting for a lull in the conversation so that I could speak. So he was waiting for her to complete. In my home, I am the woman in this story. So I speak if you don't speak. So the only way you can get a word edgewise and stop me and slow me down is to actually talk. Okay, if you don't, I'll talk. And, you know, there are, most teachers do this. I mean, if you look very worried, we talk faster. And hoping that maybe faster and with more different pitch of voice will increase the understanding. But those are all guesses. You know, if you don't understand something, stop me. That's the easiest way. But it seems as if people think we are sufficiently interactive, so I'm not too worried about that too. Any other questions, anything, any comments on this stuff? Okay. Okay. So we are going to talk about clustering starting today. And we mentioned clustering in passing. The word clustering has been mentioned several times in the beginning of the semester, for example, to cluster the results of a search engine. And we even looked at least one search engine which clusters its results, right? Vivismo does. And there are many others, you know, that are probably less well known. And there are obvious advantages for clustering search results, such that you could hopefully give one from each of the clusters, and that can improve possibly, if you have 2 clusters, one each of 100 pages long, then just picking one and giving top 10 from that is likely to lose the users who really wanted the other cluster. So a better idea would be to provide a representative of the clusters. Okay. And so the question, of course, is how do you find these clusters? Just looking at the search results, how would you find these clusters? Okay. And this winds up being a special case of a general problem of if you're given some points in some space, some data points in some space, how would you find groups of those points? Okay. Just before I actually look at some points in some space, let me say some more things here. So first of all, clustering has also been called unsupervised learning, in the sense you're trying to learn structure of the data by saying, okay, these things belong together, these things belong together, without somebody having told you that there are actually two groups here. So for example, if you have given a query that has something to do with pro-choice versus pro-life, but you didn't really know, you're from Mars and you didn't really know that the popular opinion is sort of divided into two halves. Okay, the search engine essentially is in that situation. So it just basically finds the results for this, and some are in one direction, some are in the other direction. And it then needs to show the clusters. And how many clusters are there? Well, you and I know that maybe there are only two clusters, but the search engine doesn't even know. I mean, the program that's doing clustering has to somehow figure out that there are some number of groupings in this data, and each group has the following elements in it. Okay, this is unsupervised in the sense I never told you how many groups there are. I never told you anything about what belongs to what group. I mean, I being any teacher outside of this program. Okay, so it's called unsupervised learning. And it, you know, as I said, it finds lots and lots of applications in many different scenarios. You would wind up trying to find, you know, clusters among data points. Within search engines, you could do clustering to structure the search results. You could also do clustering to suggest related pages. You can do clustering to sort of generate automated directories. So for example, Yahoo directory currently, and DMOS directory, to a large extent DMOS directory definitely, but Yahoo definitely, was actually made by humans. So the topic directory was made by humans. There's actually, I believe I know this woman who made a ton of money by being, I forget her name, Srini something. She was a Stanford library science graduate. And you know, library science people weren't expecting to make gazillion billions, even though they do good stuff. And she happened to be Yahoo employee number 5 or 6. And she was the librarian for the internet. She essentially generated the Yahoo directory, at least the first version of it. Okay. Now, what I would like to do this automatically. Okay, that's basically unstructured, unsupervised clustering. Okay, and it could have advantages in lots and lots of places if you could develop that sort of directories. And then finally, finding even things like finding near identical and duplicate pages, it's also connected to clusters. So in a sense, you could think of aggregate similarity between this page and a group of pages, where a group of pages being a cluster, okay? So there are all sorts of these things that you could use it for. So having said that, right now, for the next almost several slides, you could be in any class which is interested in clustering data points. For now, I would just be talking about clustering at a level which would transcend our specific applications. Every once in a while, I'll make connections to it, but our specific applications are, we have probably web pages that we want to cluster, okay? But much of this information, some of the algorithms, several of the algorithms that we're discussing are really general. They work for pretty much any type of data, okay? In particular, we're actually going to look at vector data, okay? So here is an interesting thing. Suppose I have the following two-dimensional space in which I have a bunch of points. These are vectors. Now, since you are in this class, let's act as if these vectors are actually text documents. These are text documents defined in terms of two keywords because it's two-dimensional. Okay? And so, now, it could be defined in terms of two keywords. That's one thing. That's one obvious way of thinking about it. What other way could you have actually talked about text documents? What other dimensions do text documents vary? So you could think of similarity between text documents in terms of keywords right, in terms of the obvious keyword between them. But we at least talked about one other different distance between text documents. What? Length of the document. No, but yeah, it's sort of connected to the number of keywords and so on. But there are other things. Yes, length is also an interesting point. In fact, you could very well have plotted this such that, you know, I don't know what it would mean in two dimensions, but in one dimension, you could actually have put the documents are all put in terms of their size. Okay, the big documents will be on this side, the small documents will be on this side. Okay, now that would be a different looking graph, that would be a different looking plot. That too will have clusters. So if it turns out that, in fact, in the web, you know, there are really three representative sized pages, you know, really large pages which are more than 2,500 words long, really small pages which are less than 25 words long, and sort of medium pages which are about 300 words long. Suppose that's the way the web documents are in terms of their sizes. You might want to know that. You might want to know, is it one of those large pages I'm talking about? Is it one of those short pages I'm talking about? That's a different kind of description of these pages. Okay. You could also be talking about these web pages, these vectors, in a space of, for example, co-citation. You know, for example, who is citing who? Who is linking to who? Okay. The reason I brought this up is, before you go from your actual application to this picture, you make some very important decisions as to what is the space in which my points are. And it, you know, in general, in our clustering algorithms, it's acting, you act as if the space is obvious. Far from it. Space is not obvious. You use your brain to decide what space you're looking for clusters. Okay? So, I have already went from text data, some text documents, you know, web pages, into some space. I've represented them as vectors in some space. In deciding the coordinate axis, I have decided in some sense what are the distances between, I've decided what are the important features of this document. And so then everything else that we will talk about, such as distances between documents, would have to be in that space. Okay, so distance between documents where the documents have been grouped in terms of their sizes is the size difference. The distance between documents where the documents have been grouped in terms of their keyword appearance would be something like vector similarity metric or the Jaccard similarity metric. Okay, a distance for co-citation would be a co-citation based distance. How many common co-citations are there? I mean, how many common pages are being cited by these pages, or how many common pages are citing both of these? Okay. Now, notice that, in fact, you could actually say that co-citation, we haven't talked about this in length, but could you think of why co-citation patterns could be of use in web search? I know, for example, that if I have seen a page, I'm looking at a page for a long time, the system can assume that other pages that are similar to that page in terms of content are also probably of interest to me. Okay, could I make the same sort of assumption in terms of co-citations? Yeah. In fact, who does it? For example, a sort of co-citation is what Amazon uses when it is trying to say that people who bought this page book also bought this record. Now, what has books and records got to do with each other? Other than the fact that same guy is citing both of them, same guy is buying both of them. And so, since you're buying this, you may be interested in this. Since you're looking at this page, other people who looked at this page wound up looking at this page too. So, would you like to look at it? That's basically, you're getting into collaborative filtering, which is what happens in Amazon every day. And you could do this for search engines too. Okay, so, probably I'm belaboring this point, but remember that before you come into this picture where all the data is points, some vector points in some space, you have made some crucial decisions as to what is it that you're trying to cluster over? What is it that you're trying to find patterns over? Okay, and so having done that, now there are points here in some space. So the question then is, what are the clusters here? And I'll just ask you, what are the clusters here? Obviously, you have some idea, right? I mean, you know, you were saying, for example, that, you know, maybe this is one cluster, maybe this is one cluster. So my question would be, why can't that be one cluster and that be one cluster? Why not? Why not? What makes clusters? Assuming that you have some space and some distance measure in that space, that's what we'll assume for the rest of the class. What makes clusters good clusters versus bad clusters? The cluster itself should be tight. You should be very, if you are in a group, you better be very similar to everybody else in that group. And to the extent this is a group different from other groups, these groups be as distinct from each other as possible. Otherwise, the groups are kind of falling over into each other. There's no real separate grouping at all. Okay, so the obvious things are, that intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster separation. Those are two important things that you look for. Okay, so for example, in this particular scenario, I gave you cluster one, cluster two, and you're a program. Okay, and I gave you this is cluster one, this is cluster two, and then somebody else gives you here is cluster one, here is cluster two. You're a program, you have never seen anything in life other than just points and distances. You can still say, you know, the second one is not as good as first one. Because in the second one, the clusters are not as tight, first of all. And second of all, they're not as distant from each other. Both ways, you're dead. So the first one is better than the second one. I don't know what domain you're talking about. I don't know what your distance means. I still know that the second one is not as good a cluster as the first one. Okay. Now, I did mention this already, which is you already decided, in deciding the distance measure, you decided the space, in essence. When you decided the space, that's exactly when you decide the distance measure. Okay. Okay. The other issue, of course, is, so in terms of good versus bad clusters, it is, you know, you look for intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster separation. The real question is, what are the true clusters? Suppose it actually is the case that this is, you know, this was generated, you know, by some process. And if I know the details of the process, I would know that this is one cluster, these four are one cluster, these two are another cluster. It's possible. Okay, I happen to know it. Okay, can this happen in search engine scenario? Yes, because at the time you gave the answers to a query on, let's say, Roe v. Wade as the keyword, you got some, you know, 100 results. Okay, and having found, let's say, two clusters automatically, now the question is, the users have to agree with you. The users have, I mean, they understand English. They understand meaning. Okay, they have to agree with you that the way you made the clusters is actually correct. So in fact, one way you can test whether or not a clustering algorithm is good is if you were to give these 100 documents to random focus group people, okay, and ask them, you know, tell me, you know, these are a bunch of documents about Roe v. Wade, and I'm trying to separate them into two classes. Tell me what should be the two classes. And so they will give you two clusters. So you can actually compare what humans gave as the two clusters with the two clusters or the five clusters you found. That would be external measure of validity of clustering. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this you don't get to do it normally. You only get to do it every once in a while to actually see if the clustering algorithm has any connection to the semantics of the domain. Okay. But normally, so that's basically like, this is sort of, this external measure is like precision recall study in search engines, right? Basically, you are, the users know with respect to their query what is relevant, what is irrelevant. And the systems guess. And to the extent the systems guess corresponds to the user's knowledge, you know, oracular knowledge, then you can talk about precision and recall with respect to that. And the same thing in the case of clusters. Yes, sir.
Doesn't having an external measure turn this into a classification problem?
That's a very good point. No, here's the interesting question. So, you are, So there's a difference between not ever having a teacher versus having a teacher who has no time for you, which most of you probably know. Okay, do you understand? So if you went to Mars and you are the only person on Mars, I mean not even Mars, some planet K, R, you know, galaxy M, okay, you are the only person and you are trying to figure out patterns on this place. Now the patterns that you found could be totally wrong patterns. And so there is nobody to check whether you are going in the right direction or not. So in that case, it's truly unsupervised in the sense not only do you have any knowledge at the time when you made the cluster, it's not even the case that you can pay $100 to somebody and get your answers checked every once in a while. More reasonably speaking, in scenarios where you do this on the earth, in places like, let's say, the web page relevance and so on, there are people who actually tell that, you know, it's not that I am paranoid and I'm seeing two clusters in the answers to the query Roe v. Wade. Many, many people would see it. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it is actually a very important point that unsupervised only means you are not bothering the teacher. Don't bother me, go do your work and come back. Okay? But then I will have an exam and then I'll say, sorry, you didn't learn correctly. And then, you know, I can fail you. Okay? So the point here is that, and in fact, you can make it more and more supervised by providing more and more feedback. So in fact, variations of clustering algorithms also include things like, here are the clusters, here is my data points, and I can tell you that this point and this point are not in the same cluster. Irrespective of what you do, I can tell you this and this are not in the same cluster. So this is a lazy teacher who doesn't want to spoon feed you. He says, you know, these are pieces of information I can tell you about this data, and then try finding out clusters. So you know that after many, many clusterings you can do, at least you should, you know, if you want to be respectful to your teacher's advice, you should keep those 2 points differently. So it's sort of, there's a continuum between fully unsupervised and fully supervised. Okay? Yes? To the extent you have classes known upfront for everything. So the tricky problem is the following thing. Roe v. Wade, if to the extent the only thing that your search engine ever has to do is to classify Roe v. Wade correctly, you can do it as a classification problem. What we are saying is, irrespective of the query, you should find the structure in the result. On particular cases, you can check whether or not it's working correct. So that's why it's still different from full classification learning. Okay. So anyway, I want you to understand, we will actually spend a lot of time on these. In developing algorithms, we want to at least make sure that even if the teacher isn't there, we should be reasonable. So for example, we know that irrespective of whether the teacher is looking over our shoulder or not, we should write clearly in our exams. You know, writing it clearly doesn't increase your points. But at least you know those are minor things, syntactic things that you should make sure. So clusters should be tight, intra-cluster tightness should be high, inter-cluster distance should be high. So this is basically, even without anybody telling you, these are syntactic considerations you can use in designing clustering algorithms. And then having done this, then you can go and, you know, you can do an external measure every once in a while, external validation once in a while, and see which approach for clustering is working better. Okay. Okay. So these are basically restatement of all the same things that I was talking about. There are some variations in when you're trying to find clusters. First of all, are the clusters supposed to be hard or soft? So are the clusters supposed to be disjoint, or can they actually have, can items have membership in multiple clusters at the same time? I mean, previous example just shows that clusters are disjoint. But you could actually have, most normal clusters may be such that each item has a degree of membership in each of the clusters. So in fact, if there are k clusters, each item has a, you know, k array vector giving its membership degree in each of the clusters. And if those vectors are all ones and zeros, and suppose they should add up to one, basically those membership numbers should add up to 1. If those are all vectors of 1s and zeros, then you know it's disjoint clustering. Anything else is soft clustering. Okay, so that's an important issue. The other thing is, do we know how many clusters we are supposed to be looking for? In some cases you do, in some cases you don't. Can you think of any example, not necessarily in web scenarios, you know, where you know how many clusters you're supposed to be looking for? Somehow that's given to you as, you know, naturally given to you as part of the knowledge. Your life depends on it, let me tell you that. Every day when you take a course, your life is based on me clustering you guys at the end of the semester into 5 groups, A, B, C, D, E. A, B, C, D, E. You know, that, why? Because university told me I can only give 5 letter grades. Now I guess it's more than 5 actually. A plus B, B minus, all that stuff. But whatever, there is a discrete number of groups. So I know exactly how many groups I'm looking for. Okay? So there are scenarios where you have that knowledge. So in fact, knowing that makes it less unsupervised than not knowing that. Right? Because knowing that you should be looking for 4 clusters is actually giving some knowledge about what pattern you're looking for. Again, this is the issue of, you talk in general about unsupervised versus supervised learning, but that's like a degree. You know, more unsupervised versus less unsupervised. Okay, a clustering algorithm which is given the number of clusters to look for is somewhat more supervised than a clustering algorithm which isn't even given that. Okay, and a clustering algorithm which is not only given the number of clusters to look for, but also is told that these pairs of points must be in the same cluster, and these pairs of points cannot be in the same cluster, is even more supervised than the first 2 clustering algorithms. Okay? Then what else? What is a good cluster? We talked about this at length, you know, interval, you know, the internal measures versus external measures. And then the other issue is the notion of distance is very important. And I mentioned that again, I want to mention it again many, many times before I'm done, because for some reason I'm thinking about it today. And so distance, the way you define distance between the thingies that you're trying to cluster before you convert them into vectors is very important. Okay? And depending on the distance measure, you get different clusters. If you're looking for co-citation-based distance measures, don't expect the clusters to make sense in terms of content. And if you're looking for clusters based on content, don't expect them to make sense in terms of co-citations. I can write a paper which is almost like a copy of the paper Jeff Ullman wrote. So it would be exact copy of it. And I can guarantee you that nobody who is citing Jeff Ullman's paper would cite me. In fact, they will probably report me to plagiarism police. Okay? So content-wise, we are identical. Co-citations-wise, there's nobody who is citing that guy who's citing me. So there's a completely different notions of grouping. Okay. And you know, this stuff about sensitivity to outliers will become clearer as we go on. One of the interesting things is, so suppose you have this, right? And then there is one other point here. These 2 and a point here. So what do you do then? So there is this one point which is sitting far away from any other 2 other things. So you could increase the number of clusters so that this guy is in its own cluster. In fact, many a time what happens is, because this guy is there, many clustering algorithms would then say, hey, you know, these guys can make a little cluster by themselves. And these guys can make another cluster. You'll see this kind of thing happening. And in fact, my favorite example is, I normally wind up doing clustering right before the midterm, and so I use the midterm marks of the people to show how various clustering algorithms are, you know, stable versus unstable in terms of giving you grades. And that tends to make people pay attention, but this time we are still too early. But I'll still use that example in the mail for somebody else's marks. But the point is, once you have these outliers, you have this decision of saying, well, you know, this data point I won't care. It's neither in this cluster, this is not part of my problem. If I ignore that, the clusters I would find would be different from if I also consider that. Okay. The other thing that I should mention is, we've been talking about tightness, right? And we've been talking about inter-cluster distance. Okay, so how do I talk about tightness of this cluster? So suppose this is a cluster, right? How do I talk about the tightness of this cluster? I can basically sum the distances between all the points. So I can actually take sum of squares of all the distances. That would be a measure that needs to be made smaller and smaller. So sum of squares of distances between points in the same cluster should be made small. Okay. Another way is actually to talk about, instead of, so the way I said that is like basically you take every pair of points in the cluster, every pair of points in the cluster, and you take that distance, okay, square it and add them all. So there are n square distances being added. Okay. You could define it a different way. For example, you could say take the centroid of this cluster and take the distance between every point and its centroid. Square those and add them up. That's another measure of tightness. Okay? Now, here is an interesting issue. Tightness in general is more or less obvious. It turns out, in fact, that there's good relations between the two measures I just talked about. You know, pairwise distances versus the distance from the centroid. But what would you do in defining the distance between these two clusters? You have to remember that distance too, right? I mean, you have to keep that distance high and you have to keep the inside distance low. And you need both at the same time, right? So how do you define the distance between the two clusters?
If you use the centroid method, you compare the distance between the two centroids.
You could use the centroid method and you can compare the distance between that. If you don't use the centroid method, what would you do? So you could, for example, take pairs from each cluster, pairs from each, pairs of points from one pair, each pair such that one point comes from here, one point comes from here, take the distance, square those. Okay, by the way I'm going about this, you should also normalize. I mean, I'm just summing them all up, but you should also normalize so that, you know, you can compare between two different clusterings. Okay, so in this particular case, you add them all up divided by the number of, you know, pairs that you actually considered. A third thing is the following, in fact. Suppose I just want to consider the max versus min distance between the clusters. So the min distance between two clusters is the distance between its two, the two closest points in each of the clusters. Okay? That's a way of defining distance. That's nothing wrong with that. Okay. You could also define it in the other way. Keep the farthest points as far away as possible. Keep the closest points as far away as possible. I mean, keep the distance between clusters to be the distance between its two closest points. Or keep the distance between, define the distance between clusters to be the distance between their centroids. Or define the distance between two clusters to be distance between their two farthest points. To put this in terms that you can hopefully understand, what would you want me to use if I were to be clustering your marks into grades, you know, at the end of the semester? You, just forget about the rest of the class, we don't really care. Just you, yourself, you know. Pure selfishness. What would you rather have? You, everybody who ever comes to my office, and there are very few of them who actually do, when they complain about the grade, they somehow try to say that, you know, my friend who is in this, the lowest A is so close to me, so why can't I be in A? And I'm telling him, do you notice that the highest B is years away from you? And why should you be in the A grade? Do you understand what I'm saying? So the teachers are probably trying to make grades, at least people like me, you know, in trying to decide if I were to put this guy into A grade, that's a total insult to the poor guy who is at the top of the A grade. Because, you know, he does understand a lot more. Okay, so I am looking at the distance between the farthest points in some sense. And you would want me to look at the distance between the closest points. I mean, look at it. I mean, you know, the guy who is like the last is only 5 points above me. You know, come on, you know, 5 more points. Okay, so it makes a difference which one I consider will wind up having a different clustering effect. Okay. So, in fact, they have names for these. The name for the distance between two clusters in terms of the closest points is called the single link distance. Single link distance. And the names between two clusters based on their farthest points is called the complete link distance. Okay. And the centroidal one is essentially centroidal distance. Now, here's another thing I want you to think about. What would you think would be the shapes of clusters if you were to be using? Here's one game that we're playing. I didn't tell you a single algorithm. I'm just depending on your intuitions of putting together points based on distances. Okay? What would clusters based on single link distance look like? Would they look like big circles, or would they look like sort of elongated chains? Would they look more like elongated chains or like big circles? Single link essentially talks about the distance between the two closest points. What? Chain. Okay, the another example of single link is how we cross red lights. You know, I mean, you're never talking about when the darn thing, you know, you're only caring about the fact that the guy right in front of you just about got out, so I should be able to follow. And it's like a train of cars connected to each other, so that the first guy is in fact going through the yellow, the rest are all going through red, but you know, if you're connected, it's okay. So you're considering again the cluster of cars who cross legally and the cluster of cars who are not supposed to cross, and you're trying to look at the distance in terms of the last two. That would be again single link based distance, you know. So that those are the ones you get chains of clusters. Okay, so again, the interesting thing is small decisions you make about how you define distance between clusters can have large impact on how the clusters would look like. Okay? Now, again, going back a little bit to the text stuff, you know, clustering can be done in the case of web search at the indexing time are at the query time. The examples you've seen mostly are at the query time. So for example, things like Vivismo, take your query, call a bunch of search engines, get their answers, very quickly cluster and show you the cluster. But you could also have done clustering at the indexing time, and that would be, if you were to generate an automated directory of topics, you would have to do it that way. Or in fact, Google could actually have done it, and then it could, if you click on a particular page, it could then say, here are all the other pages which are in the cluster of this page. I'll give it to you. This is an interesting way of doing relevance feedback. As soon as you click a page, then I'll give you the cluster that this page is part of. If you're interested in me, you should be interested in my entire family. Take it in. Okay? So that's the other place where you could use it. And as I said, this part we already said, clustering can be based on URL source, the distance measures. It could be based on text content. It could be based on link topology in the case of text document. Those are already three different things. Now, I'm not even getting into the issue of if you are talking about text content, if you want to give differential weights to different dimensions. Suppose I want to say that, you know, certain keywords have more importance than other keywords. We didn't do this until now, but it's a reasonable thing to do. If you were to do that, that's sort of like a dot product, except it's a dot product where certain dots or certain dimensions are being scaled higher with respect to others. So it's like, you know, one document is V1 double dash, V1 triple dash, another is V2 dash, V2 double dash, V2 triple dash. Now, normal dot product is just V1 dash, V2 dash, and plus all the other ones. Now I can say lambda 1 times this plus lambda 2 times this plus lambda 3 times this. Lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3 are arbitrary real numbers. That would scale the importance of the various keywords. That's a different, you know, distance metric. Okay? And if you do that, you'll get a different type of cluster. Okay. This, I think you've seen these kind of examples in the web. Okay, that also we did. This also we did. These are all things I actually wound up doing with that single example. This is basically talking about the fact that intra-cluster and inter-cluster distances, how are the ways in which you can define them. How hard is clustering? So here is an interesting thing. So if I were to tell you that there are, so if you were to basically consider all clusters of points, and if I were to tell you there are k clusters and there are n points, okay, one obvious way is the following thing. You do know that the measure of importance of clusters would be some metric based on the internal tightness plus the inter-cluster distance. Okay? You want to maximize both internal tightness, intra-cluster tightness, and the inter-cluster distance. So it's an objective function, and you're trying to optimize that. And so if I give you five clusters, you can figure out five cluster rings of the data, you can figure out which wins according to your objective metric. So the right thing to do always is find out how to do it brute force way before thinking of doing it smart ways. Okay? So the brute force way would be find out all possible clusterings. And if you only have n points and you know that they are looking, you're looking for k clusters, how many possible clusterings are there? And it turns out it will be basically k power n by k factorial. You can work this out yourself. Point is, it's a large number, not a good number to play with. Okay? So you don't want to make all those clusters and look at their cost one by one. Okay, this is sort of like saying that one way of sorting n numbers is to generate all n permutations of those numbers, and I have a little tester which checks whether it's a sorted permutation or not. That's an algorithm that works, but you took 310 and you know that you're not supposed to write that. If you do, you lose your computer science license. Okay, so basically this is the background, this is the solution criterion. This is a brute force method. Now, how do you do it better than this? Okay. Normally, what you would do is you would do things like iterative. No, unlike, you know, in the case of sorting, actually, there is an exact method which is, in fact, you know, n log n, which will give you the sorted sequence without you having to do this crazy thing of finding all the permutations. You know, in this case, what we're going to look at is, you know, many of the scenarios we would be looking for iterative descent methods, for example. So try to generate a reasonably good cluster iteratively. So you make a cluster, look at it. If it doesn't look good, push people around. Not people, items around. Now, actually, the reason I said people is because one of the classic methods for clustering is k-means, which we'll be discussing today, at least. Okay? And then there are hierarchical clustering methods. And then, you know, there's a whole bunch of clustering methods. We'll at least talk about two important ones, which are basically elementary clustering methods, k-means and hierarchical clustering. Okay. Now, in the case of k-means, the easiest way to understand k-means is, at least in my way of thinking, it's basically the way our kids form into groups. You know, you go, if you are a teacher in an elementary school, you go into the school and into the class and say, I need to form three groups, quickly join into three groups. And so the kids will, you know, some kid will start standing in one place and other kids will start, you know, grouping around various, you know, if there are three kids, so the three kids would wind up starting in one place and other kids will like naturally go to the right, you know, one group. And then after they join the group, they look around and they find that all their enemies are in the group they joined. And so they quickly run to the other group and the same thing will happen from the other groups. You know, for a while off, this crazy thing happens where people are shifting groups around until they think they are in the group where their friends are and farthest from the group where their enemies are. Okay? And it stabilizes. It stabilizes mostly because teachers say, stop moving around. You know, we start playing now. K-means is that. K-means is exactly that idea, except without cute kids, but data points. Okay? So what k-means algorithm does is it requires, so it's not a fully unsupervised algorithm, it requires the number of clusters be provided as input to it. So the teacher comes and says, make into three groups, so three clusters. Okay. So all that happens in k-means essentially is three random data points will be chosen as the leaders of the three clusters. Then everybody computes their distance to the leader of the current three leaders. And whichever leader is their closest, whichever laser is the friendliest, they go join that group. Okay? Now, having done this, having computed this initial clustering, then the second phase essentially says, what is the centroid of this group, and this group? So I know that I joined this first group because I like the leader. But then it turns out all my enemies like the leader too. So they came and joined it. So in fact, now this group is no longer as interesting to me. So one way of figuring out whether a group is representative to you is take the centroid, for example, of this cluster. Okay? So after the initial iteration is over, you compute the centroid, new centroids of the three clusters. And now those, the centroids, remember, centroids are not real people, and not real data points. They don't exist in the original data. But they're vectors. And every vector now computes its distance to these new centroids and sees whichever it is closest to, and it moves into those things. And you stop these iterations when not enough people are shifting anymore. In fact, you should stop when nobody is shifting. That's K-means. What's interesting is the darn thing works most of the time. I mean, you could do it in this. I'll let you look at this example later. But this is a nicer example since we've been looking at it. Okay? And so I picked crazy seeds. I picked a red seed here and a blue seed here. Okay? So red is the red group, blue is the blue group. Again, the pick is random pick. Okay? Suppose the program picked these as the seeds. Then after the first iteration, it turns out that all these red points are closer to the red seed than to the blue seed in terms of Euclidean distance. And all the blue points are closer to the blue seed than the red seed. Okay? Now what happened? Now you have a red cluster, which is pretty darn ugly looking, and a blue cluster. But all is not lost, because in fact it's clear that it's like, you know, Republican Party or Democratic Party would be hijacked by various factions of them. The red cluster got hijacked by this faction. Really. So the centroid of the red cluster is not really here. Where would it be more like? It'll be more like here. That's just a simple computation. You add up the vectors, divide it by the number of vectors. That would be the new vector. Okay? So you compute the centroids. It turns out that the red cluster centroid is here. Blue cluster centroid is here. So now you do one more iteration of points going into the right cluster. It's over in this case. In this case, it's over. And of course, you don't know that it's over. What happens is you recompute. At this point, this is the second iteration cluster. These are reds. These are blues. Now you recompute the new centroid at this point. This is no longer the center of the red cluster. The center of the cluster would be somewhere more like this. And the blue cluster would be somewhere more like this. So you do that. Those are the blue cluster, red cluster centroids. Now you ask everybody, does anybody want to move? And you can see in this case, nobody is going to move because they're close to their centroids. So between two iterations, nobody moved. So there's no point in wasting time. Clustering is over. Okay, that's K-means clustering. Very simple idea. Okay. It converges in this case. Here is real looking data, more ugly looking real looking data. In this case, I forget what this is, it's a two dimensional antenna data. It's about some data points about how various antennae work in electrical engineering. Okay? And they are defining these data points in terms of two dimensional space. Okay? Now, clearly, this is unlike our previous data. There are more points here, some of them are noisy. Okay, so what am I looking for? I'm trying to do K-means clustering, and I'm doing K-means clustering with K equal to 3 in this case. And they show, even if they start with all the seeds somewhere close to each other, as the iterations go on, they naturally find one seed going here, one seed going here, one seed going here. I mean, one centroid going here, one centroid going here, one centroid going there. And so they find three right clusters. Yes, sir.
So when we try to pick the seed for the centroid, can we try to pick the seed as far as possible as the first one?
Yes. So in fact, we actually started with the random approach. We basically picked the wrong, you know, any random seeds, and we worked on it. Now, it turns out that actually, in fact, to answer your question, take this data. Okay, here ABC, ABCDE. Okay, now you can actually do it yourself. If you were to pick B and E as the centroids, okay, you get the clusters ABC and DEF, if you're looking only for two clusters. If you were to pick D and E as the centroid, as the initial seeds, you would look at ABDE as one cluster, CF as other cluster. Now, you decide which clustering you like. The more important point for me is based on the initial assignment, I wind up going to a different cluster. Now, it may well be that in this particular case, it's sort of obvious, I think, even if you look at the tightness measures of the cluster, intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster distance, this clustering is nicer than that clustering. However, the friend of yours who started with B and E as the seeds will come to that clustering and stop there. There is nothing more to do for them because nobody is changing seeds. Nobody is changing sites. You have to start with a different set of seeds. So I said iterative method. Normally, iterative methods don't guarantee optimum anything. Okay? So in fact, if you were to look at what happens to, here is a simple example that we can look at, which is easier to understand. If you were to look at what happens in one dimension, there are like a bunch of numbers there, and define distance between the numbers as the absolute difference between them, squared, if you want. Okay? And you can talk about finding the clusters, k equal to 2. Now, having found, in this particular case, what happens is what you expect it to happen, which is 1, 2 would be in one cluster, 5, 6, 7 will be another cluster. You can do this at home. And then if you compute the cluster tightness, okay, in terms of for every element, compute the distance between it, the distance between it and its centroid, okay, and sum them and add them all for all the elements in all the clusters. So each element would be looking at the different centroid based on the cluster it is in. Now, in essence, it can be shown that this number, if you minimize this number, you are in essence doing the simultaneously doing the tightening of the clusters and maximizing the distances between the clusters. So the issue is how to get this to be smaller. And you can show that as k-means progresses from iteration to iteration to iteration, this measure will keep reducing. So every time this measure reduces, I'll send you some examples showing this actually happens, but you know, it's sort of obvious that's actually what is happening in the example you saw. Okay? This measure keeps reducing, and however, it reaches some point, which is the minimum it can reach, and it stops there. That point may not be the global minimum. That can be the local minimum. So if you were to look at the space of all clusterings and this metric in the space of all clusterings, this metric essentially has global, it doesn't have a single global minimum. It has multiple local minimum like that. And based on where you start, you're likely to fall into the closest local minimum. Okay? So the point that you basically got into was seed selection matters. And if you were to pick the right seed, then you can actually get to the global maximum, global minimum. So what are the ideas you could try for that? So the seed selection, let's see, where do we talk about seed selection? Yeah. Since the seed selection matters, you know, one idea which anybody with a gigahertz computer can try multiple seeds. You know, so try multiple random seeds. Okay. Remember that the way you said, which is try to start with the farthest. it may not be obvious. Well, of course, you could always start with the farthest among all pairs of data points in all the data. That's a reasonable idea. Okay, but what if I want to look for 5 clusters? 2, that's a reasonable idea. If I want to look for 3, already you're in trouble.
Recursive.
What?
Recursive.
What is recursively? No, 3 would be hard, right? Because then you have to pick one of them and then split it into 2 clusters. Recursive is a good idea. We'll look at that actually in a minute. Okay, so the basic thing is that there is no obvious way of picking the right seeds. Okay, and so one idea would be try multiple starting points and see whichever, and you know, since it's a cheap enough algorithm, it's basically a linear time algorithm, try multiple clusters, generate clusters with respect to each, try multiple seeds, for each seed generate a clustering, compare their goodness. Again, after the class, you know, if you look at your email, I'll send you a long email with some hypothetical, you know, midterm marks of some people who actually took this class before you, and how we could cluster them such that different people will get different kinds of grades. Okay, based on, for example, things like distances, based on starting centroids, using the same basic method, which is k-means. Okay. There are other ideas that we can try, it turns out. For example, is basically doing this idea called bisecting k-means, which is exactly what Niyati was talking about. Okay? So bisecting k-means says, what bisecting k-means says is, always try to split the data into 2 clusters. At every time, try to split it into 2 clusters. Okay? So in the beginning, there is only a single cluster. So first you pick a cluster, split it into 2 clusters. That's what you do. So in the very beginning, and since you're always splitting it into only 2 clusters, you only have to try 2 seeds. So you can even use your kind of heuristic. If not, you could try still, in this particular case, you try multiple seeds, and try doing clustering with respect to them, and say which is the best. And in fact, there's one more thing that happens here, which is in the kth iteration, what you do is you have multiple clusters in front of you. You consider splitting any one of those clusters. So I will consider splitting the first cluster. This is the best I'm able to do. I'm considering splitting the second cluster. This is the best I'm going to do. Now the best is measured by the sum of least squares distance. And then I will commit to the cluster which seems to, whose split seems to lead to the lowest least square distance. Turns out that bisecting k-means is actually a pretty darn good algorithm. And in fact, the paper that I asked you to read in the readings for clustering, the main paper, says that bisecting k-means does quite well on text data, which makes you wonder why should there be tons and tons of books on clustering. This is so hard, so easy to understand. Okay. But it works quite fine in text data. Okay. I want to make another interesting comment here, which is clustering can be thought of as compression. Why do you really think university wants to put you guys into 5 grades A, B, C, D, E? Why? Why can't people be allowed to have their exact marks? You know, I mean, so, you know, person one, total cumulative mark is, you know, gazillion million 0.375985. That's their total number. And we have computers, we can, even my kid can take gazillion million 0.3475 and another one which is of that same size and decide which is bigger. So the reason, why do you think people actually put you in clusters? Nothing to do with anything to, nothing, not necessarily to do with patterns, but to do with compression. It's easier to compress the data, you know, instead of putting so many numbers, I'll just put 4, you know, 5 different numbers, A, B, C, D, E, and if I average this a little bit more. So in fact, finding clusters is intimately connected to compressing data. Intimately connected to compressing data. In fact, the first phase of compressing data is the same as first phase of finding patterns, which is finding clusters. Okay? The thing that is interesting about the, so the interesting about the learning part is after you have made the clusters, then a new document comes, you should be able to tell which cluster it should fall into. Now you tell me that if I give you ABCDE grades, I can then look at the guy who comes from that room and know which grade he should be in. Pretty darn hard. Okay, so I'm really doing it for you guys for compression. Now, compression is a good thing. Lots of times you want to compress data such that you can store it, you know, with less amount of space. Okay, so here is an idea called vector quantization, which is like the top, one of the top compression ideas currently in image processing. And if you say vector quantization, if I say vector quantization, you won't understand. And if you go tell EE people K means, they won't understand. But you know vector quantization because that's exactly does K means. Vector quantization is K means. Okay? And the nice thing is, you can decide the K because you're trying to compress. You want to look for, you know, if you want to really compress, look for only few clusters. So the idea in clustering would be that for the entire cluster, I'll throw away the actual elements of the cluster and just remember the centroid and make the centroid be the representative for the entire cluster. So going back to this particular picture, this guy is Ronald Fisher, who is a great statistician who actually did a lot of interesting stuff in machine learning, I mean, in statistics, which winds up being useful for learning. So this is the first picture. It's a 256, I mean, it's an 8-bit picture. That means each point, it's a 1024 by 1024 array, where each point in this array is an 8-bit number. It's an 8-bit number. Okay, now I don't want to waste space. I want to reduce the size of the image that I'm storing. So one idea would be to say, look, I'm going to look for K clusters in this image, K clusters in this image. And for each cluster, I'll only remember one point. And everybody in that cluster actually gets that as their number. So instead of a 1024 by 1024 array of completely different numbers, which may coincidentally be similar to each other in nearby neighborhoods, you are now forcing them to be same in certain areas. Now you all know this. When you actually see low quality images, you get this equal intensity little blurs. That's what they're doing. They're basically saying all those, you know, bits there are actually the same value. And so it starts looking somewhat silly. Okay, so now here's the interesting thing. This picture, the way the vector quantization works is they take blocks of the image. Okay, so in this case, they took a 2x2 block. So a 2x2 block there, a 2x2 block there, a 2x2 block there. Okay, and so there are 512 times 512. 2x2 blocks in this image, if it's a 1024 by 1024 image. Now each block has four numbers. Think of it as a four-dimensional vector. Okay? And use any vector distance measure, maybe, you know, dot product distance. And then you have everything that is needed to do clustering. All you need is K. Okay? This picture, I decided K would be 200. So I'm looking for 200 different clusters in the picture. And then having found the cluster, then I would essentially say everybody in that cluster has the same value, which is the value of the centroid of that cluster. Okay? This guy looks still very much similar to this guy. And we saved some space. In fact, instead of 8 bits per cell, we actually came down to 1.9 bits. Per cell, 1.9 bits per pixel, just by doing this. Not a bad deal. This is even weird. I'm looking for four clusters, K equal to four. Right? K equal to four. And he still looks like Ronald Fisher. He's invariant to vector quantization. Okay. But there's a beautiful point here, which is compression is connected to clustering. Okay, so if you ever hear about a compression algorithm, you could use it in clustering algorithms. If you hear about, you know, for example, have you heard of What does JPEG use? JPEG does compression, right? What does JPEG use?
Fast Fourier transforms.
Yeah, that's okay, but anybody else better than that? Fast Fourier transforms is way out there for a computer science guy to even know the name, but that's still not the correct one.
Oh, okay.
What? Wavelet. So you're in the wrong department. So wavelets are actually, in fact, JPEGs originally used discrete cosine transform. You know, I'm masquerading. My undergraduate degree is in electrical engineering, so I still remember some things. Plus, my wife is electrical engineer, so I know even more. But JPEG uses wavelet transforms. Okay, and in general, all these transforms, the way Fourier transform works, in essence, is it converts the data into frequency domain, and if you want to cut down the size, you get rid of the high demand, high frequency parts of the transform. And those would be the ones which are like small changes in small regions. And if most of the time that's kind of noisy and people don't mind getting rid of that. And if you get rid of that, then you can, you know, cut down the size. Now it turns out that Fourier transforms, wavelet transforms, all these things can actually be, you know, they can be back used in learning algorithms, clusterings and so on. So once you realize that clustering is connected to compression, you can then say something that works there can work here too. Okay, and here actually is a simple algorithm called K-means, which is basically goes under, I mean, if you read, actually you should try to read, go to, Google and say vector quantization, and get a page on vector quantization, and see how much jargon there is. They would use words like code book. That looks like CIA stuff. What code book is the list of centroids of the cluster. Okay. And, you know, fields evolve independently, and sometimes the same idea winds up being used across multiple fields. So don't give up right away just because you don't hear the obvious connections. But, you know, in this case, once you realize that compression has to have something to do with clustering, you could see the points. Let's see what else. Couple more points about K-means, and we'll end today. So this I already talked about. It tends to go to local minima based on the initial seeds, and so you should try multiple seeds. Okay. The other thing is need to know K in advance. We've been talking about this problem. You know, you need to be told how many clusters are there. That's like cheating because it's not a completely hands-off teacher. The teacher told you there are 5 patterns here. Look for them. Instead of, you know, if you're doing whatever the treasure hunt kind of thing, if somebody tells you there are 5 things to look for, it's better than go look for things. And you don't know when you're done, right? So being told only 5 things are there is helpful. Okay. So the question is, how do you deal with this if I don't have that information? Okay. In the case of grading, I know that information. I know I will fit it. One of the problems with K-means is if you give it a value K, it will find K clusters for you. You can take bipartite data. Here is one very close set of points. Out here is another close set of points. It's totally bipartite. Okay? And you give K equal to 15, it will find you 15 clusters. It has no brain. It's basically doing the obvious comparison. Okay? So you better actually try to find the right set of clusters. The one thing that happens is the following. What you could do, of course, you could say is that you could try guessing the values of K. Okay? Try K equal to 2 first, find the clustering. Then try K equal to 3, find the clustering. Compare the sums of distances measured with respect to K equal to 2 and K equal to 3. And then keep going until you find the minimum for K. How many of you think this is a good idea? Why is it wrong? Forget about time. I mean, ASU computers are there. So why is it a bad idea? If there are n points, what's the maximum clusters you can have? N. What's the sum of squares distance for n clusterings, an n size clustering of n points? What? Zero. Zero. So there's no minimum. The minimum is at n equal to k. Right? So you can't just think about that. So what you do, however, is the following. You draw for k on the x-axis the sum square distance on the y-axis, you get a, you know that this thing will become 0 where k equal to m. The question is there a kink in this graph? Is there a kink in this graph? So if in fact, for the example I gave you where there is one cluster here, one cluster there, okay, you would pretty much reach the minimum with k equal to 2, and after that you would be changing much slowly until you become 0 when k equal to n. So you should eyeball the data, the variation, and look for the kink. Now all the time there might not be a kink. Okay, different data, in some cases actually when there are naturally occurring clusterings, if you try multiple sizes of multiple number of clusters and plot this, you would know that there's a particular place where there's a major change in the sum of square distance. So that's the right place to stop. Beyond that, you're looking for more clusters than there's actually there in the data. Before that, you're combining existing clusters. That's the best idea I can give you. Okay? And we answer it in a different way next class, I mean not next class, maybe class after next, where we'll say, we won't ever tell you how many clusters we have. I have a hierarchical organization of the data, and if you want 5 clusters, I'll give you 5. If I want 7 clusters, I'll give you 7. If you want n clusters, I'll give you n. Basically, it's a hierarchy depending upon, it's a tree. And depending upon where I cut the tree, I can get any number of clusters I want. That's called hierarchical clustering, and we'll try that next class. Okay? And then the final thing, the final two things are, k-means assumes that the clusters are disjoint, so it's not half clusters, and it also assumes that the clusters are spherical, mostly. The way k-means works is it assumes that the clusters are spherical. So if you don't have spherical clusters, it will find spherical clusters for you. That would be the Procrustean bed aspect of it. Okay? We'll stop here. We'll go back to hierarchical clustering. The class after that, next class, we'll do Google paper.